to start today in the nation's capital, where a $2,000 tug-of-war continues. Here's what's going on. Both congressional Democrats and Republican President Donald Trump have called for increasing the individual stimulus checks from the $600 that were signed into law Sunday night to $2,000. Now, yesterday, the House passed a bill that would do that, and that included votes from more than 40 House Republicans. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey joined Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in threatening to hold up other key business in the Senate if that bill doesn't come to a vote in the Senate. Now, earlier today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked a vote, saying that the Senate would take up the issue, but along with two other Donald Trump priorities: removing legal protections for social media companies in a defense spending bill, and investigating what the president has called, quote, very substantial voter fraud, end quote, in the 2020 election, the latter being despite no credible evidence behind the claim. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey is with us on the line. Senator Markey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
It's great to have you. I want to start. I know the $2,000 is the goal. Does it need to be voted on in the form of this House bill that was passed yesterday, or would it be acceptable to you, as long as $2,000 gets voted on, if it's part of some other piece of legislation?
No, it should just be $2,000. That's what Trump supports. That's what just got voted out of the House of Representatives. That's what actually, Marco Rubio and other Republican senators are saying that they support, just straight up or down, yes or no, do you want to give $2,000 to individuals who make less than $70,000 a year? We don't have to worry about the billionaires. Billionaires have made, unbelievably, in the United States this year, they've made over $1 trillion additional dollars this year. The stock market is good to them. The bond market is good to them. What's really a very, very dangerous, threatening situation is the number of people being thrust into poverty, you know, who are hungry, who are desperate to pay their bills, pay for the food for their family, pay for the rent, pay for the mortgage. All of that is creating a crisis,
Senator,
for families all across the country. And so we should just have an up or down vote on whether or not the Republicans are willing to provide that additional, in this case, $1,400 on top of the $600 that they've already supported.
So a couple of things in follow-up there. First, clearly $600 is not going to help somebody keep from falling into poverty. Do you feel that $2,000 is sufficient to stave off some of what you just laid out? Or is it, and I don't mean this cynically, is that just the most that we can get or that you can get in a stimulus check?
Well, Senator Sanders and Kamala Harris and I, we introduced in May legislation to give individuals $2,000 a month. So what this $2,000 does is it gives us a chance to get into the Biden administration to move on to the next step of help, which we are going to have to provide to American families. Tony Fauci has made it very clear that the worst of the crisis is ahead of us and not behind us. And it is absolutely imperative that we provide this $2,000 right now and then come back after Joe Biden is sworn in and determine what else we need to do for these families.
So let's talk about getting it done. Ostensibly, at least, Senator Markey, the issue is about deficits. The Republicans are resisting this much expenditure because of it takes us over $1 trillion and concerns about the deficit. I understand that there are many political aspects to who's, you know, worried about deficits and at what time. Do you think that that's really the issue at hand? From an outsider's perspective, it almost looks like there's just some sort of internal struggle in the Republican Party playing out right now, and it might not really be about $2,000.
Well, I think that Republicans are now becoming born again deficit hawks, but they don't have any problem with voting for a bloated defense budget, which is why Bernie Sanders and I have now objected to moving expeditiously towards the handling of that bill. It just seems that Republicans are more focused on funding a defense bill than funding for the defenseless families in our country. And
do you have any concern about the deficit with this, about the amount of money it would take to pay this $2,000? Is it just a necessary cost, or do you have concern that that might be hard on the country later?
Well, we're in a situation where we know that billionaires, as I've said, have already made more than $1 trillion in 2020 alone, on top of what they already had. It's unbelievable. It's now for the country to step up for those who are most in need, who are struggling, can't pay their bills, who have children who are hungry, who have mortgages which are being foreclosed, rent which is due. That's the job of government. That's what the government is actually set up to do. It's to ensure that families get what they need in their time of crisis. And there's no question with millions of people falling into poverty that we have an obligation to help them. Republicans, you know, historically have been very conservative in their willingness to step up. But if the government doesn't step up now, then there will be no time that is justified for Republicans to support people in need in our country. So what we're seeing, however, let's be honest, with Marco Rubio, with Senators Perdue and Loeffler from Georgia, with Josh Hawley from Missouri, and now with Donald Trump, is there seems to be real sentiment in the Republican Party to have a vote for and support for these families. So what I say is, why not just do a yes or no vote, an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate this week? That's what we're asking for, Bernie Sanders and I. It's simple.
So,
the House did it yesterday. We could do it tomorrow. Donald Trump supports it. Let's just get this help into the hands of people who need it.
So you and this, and Senator Sanders are pushing for that. It does look like there's kind of remarkable sway among some Republicans. What's at stake, though, in the approach, as I understand that you and Senator Sanders have taken, is the ability to override President Trump's veto of the defense spending bill. You referred a minute ago to bloated defense budgets. I do understand that that bill has strong bipartisan support itself and is often argued as quite necessary. Are you comfortable that the country would be safe without that override, you know, if this battle goes down to the wire?
Well, there's one thing that we don't have to worry about, which is that Republicans do support a defense bill. So I'm not concerned at all about whether or not ultimately the Defense Department will get what it needs. And by the way, there are hundreds of billions of additional unnecessary dollars that are built into the defense budget, making nuclear weapons once again a priority when we should be actually talking about protecting ordinary families. So I think ultimately the defense budget will pass. I think it's too much money in that budget, but at the same time, we can't do it unless and until we also provide for ordinary families to get the protections which they need. Nuclear weapons, more nuclear weapons, are not going to be protecting American families over the next year. It's going to be cash in their pocket in order to take care of their real family needs.
I know you know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to link this question of $2,000 stimulus checks with two other presidential priorities. I talked about them at the top, removing legal protections for tech companies like a Facebook or a Google. And the president's desire to investigate, you know, disputed claims over voter fraud, despite, you know, no substantial evidence to that. Is that a non-starter for you? Let's say that the House bill just doesn't come to the floor, the $2,000 per check doesn't come to the floor that way. Would you be open to it coming to the floor this way?
No, and it's not necessary. The issue is immediate help to families who are desperate right now. We have a health crisis in our country, an unemployment crisis, a hunger crisis, an addiction crisis, and we have a crisis of faith in our nation. And we have a moral obligation to take care of these families and to do it right now. So all these other issues, they can be dealt with in the future. But making sure that families get what they need to protect their loved ones, that has to happen immediately.
Senator, back in November, we reached a point here in the Commonwealth where more than 1 million people are hungry. You've been talking about poverty, hunger, vulnerability, evictions. What are you hearing from constituents in the Commonwealth? And what else is it going to take to keep the economic floor from just falling out from underneath our more vulnerable residents here in the Commonwealth?
Well, we do have a hunger crisis in the Commonwealth, and it's true across the whole country. And we're built in to the coronavirus package with billions of additional dollars in order to help with that crisis. We're seeing it at levels that are unprecedented. You have to go back to the Great Depression in the 1930s to see anything that's comparable. And again, it just keeps bringing us back to this point where we have to put cash in the hands of families, those that make under $70,000 a year, so that they can pay the bills. They can buy the food for their loved ones. And it should go to each individual who makes under $70,000, regardless of their status. So from my perspective, you put your finger right on it. This is a crisis. It's unprecedented. The numbers in Massachusetts mirror what's going on across the whole country, and it's time for the federal government to do something. It's time to ask our country what it can do for ordinary families in our society.
Last question for you, Senator Markey. Joe Biden is president-elect. He's a Democrat. The Senate hangs in the balance with two runoffs in Georgia in January. On your mind, what are the other big legislative priorities for 2021?
Well, we have to obviously come back and add on to the additional resources that we are dealing with that will deal with the coronavirus crisis. But at the top of the list is the climate crisis. It's getting worse and worse as each new report comes in across our country and across the planet. We can solve this problem. It's a political problem, not a technological problem. The technologies are there: wind, solar, all electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, battery storage technologies. It's all there. The racial injustice, inequality in our country, it has to be front and center as well. Environmental justice has to be front and center as well. We know there's something wrong with the country where three billionaires control more wealth than the bottom 50% of our population combined. Our economic system has gone off the rails, and it hurts black and brown and immigrant and poor families more than anyone else in our society. That should be the business of our country in 2021.
Well, that is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. I hope you'll come back in 2021 to talk about that progress. Thanks for today.
Thank you so much.
So now from Capitol Hill to Beacon Hill, where the Massachusetts Senate just about an hour ago voted to override Governor Baker's veto of the Roe Act. The House voted to override that veto yesterday. With us now is State Senator Harriet Chandler, who wrote and sponsored the Roe Act. Senator Chandler, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here on such a happy note. That's even more of a pleasure.
Well, I was going to ask you how you were feeling. I think I know now.
Exuberant.
Why?
We've worked so hard for this bill to become a law. So very hard. We started 2 years ago, and quite frankly, it has taken all of this time, and it's almost a miracle that it happened at all. And here we are. We're only a few days away from the session ending. We shouldn't even be in session at this point. If it hadn't been extended, we wouldn't have been, and this would have been a bill that never happened. So it is just, it's just a miracle in so many ways, and it's such an important miracle.
You just said this is a bill that might then never have happened, and it didn't before. This is not the first time that it's, you know, been in consideration. It didn't make it out of committee in 2019. Is it different this year because of the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that helped. Definitely think having a hostile court made people realize we're going to lose this. We're going to lose this incredible right of a woman to make decisions about her own body. And, you know, Justice Barrett makes no bones about it, where she stands on this issue. And we had never enshrined this in Massachusetts law. This was all a question of the court's rulings on it. But, you know, different people, when different people are in the majority, different things happen. So now with it in the law, as passed today by the Senate, passed yesterday by the House, with a supermajority. We voted on this three times in the last 2.5 weeks. So this is we've gone through an awful lot with this bill as well. It's remarkable, just remarkable, and people are so excited and so happy, particularly women.
State Senator Chandler, I don't want to litigate abortion rights in this conversation. We have been doing that publicly, you know, in our communities for years.
Right.
You're very excited. You're talking about women who are excited. We also know that there are those who are not pleased by this outcome. What I want to ask you about is the rhetoric around this bill. Okay, so we had two areas of controversy, one about language around abortions after 24 weeks, and one in the area of whether young women ages 16 and 17 can receive abortions without parental consent. The rhetoric has really, in this push and pull, has been strong. Massachusetts Democratic Party chair called Governor Baker a coward for the veto, and Republican Party Chair Jim Lyons said the legislation had, quote, no place in humane society, end quote. I wonder if you feel that rhetoric matches the moment. Are the stakes that high, or is that sharp rhetoric around something that there's a way to come together on? Do you understand my question?
I think there definitely is a way to come together. I think this bill tries to do it. The governor's decision was based on his feeling that 16 and 17 year olds should not have the right to make the decision about having an abortion without having the approval of either their parents or judicial bypass, which is going to the judge and asking a judge to make that decision. And in 99% of the cases, the judges always sided with the young woman, but that was one issue, and that was an issue of just, you know, what you think a 16-year-old has the right to have sexual intercourse. Shouldn't a 16-year-old also have the right to terminate if there is a product in terms of a fetus? She should have the right to control her own body. Yes, she will have the responsibility for raising the baby if it becomes a baby, and clearly she should have the right to determine what is the best time for her to have a family. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, so that, no, that's okay. So that's sort of the argument made there, and probably the argument in the House, in the State House and the State Senate for that override. I guess what I'm wondering are there other places to move? We are so divided. That rhetoric is so strong. This is another place of division in our Commonwealth. What's the coming together now as we head into 2021 with some of these very controversial pieces of legislation behind us?
Well, I really believe that in this case, 88% of Massachusetts citizens believe in the right to abortion and the right of young women to make that decision themselves. So that I don't think it is as divided as perhaps other issues that we're facing as a nation and as a state. I think that it's a lot of loud rhetoric from a smaller group than perhaps they would acknowledge. So I don't think that that's true. In terms of late-term abortions, everyone, including the governor, understood the reason for including fatal fetal anomalies in the issue of whether there should be late-term abortions. Late-term abortions are done as a last gap kind of measure when a doctor discovers, usually very late in the pregnancy, that there is a fatal fetal anomaly, some sort of a problem that will not allow the fetus to live outside of the womb. And to make a woman either live with that until the fetus actually goes into labor, or until she has enough money and enough whatever to get herself to the only two states in the country, New Mexico and Colorado, that do what is normally called late-term abortions, which is what we're talking about here. Here we have the
state senator.
Yep.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time. Just finish up that thought real quick, please. It's okay. All right, let's just end
there. There's so much to say about this.
I know.
The issue. There's so much. I don't think there's going to be this long-term feeling of division on this subject. I think that this decision and the fact that we passed this with a supermajority in both the House and the Senate, we voted on it three times. I think that perhaps gets over some of the questions and the issues.
Good.
I think we've had 2 years to explain it, and I think we've explained it fairly well. So I think it's a wonderful thing, and I want to thank particularly the Speaker
I'm
of the House
sorry.
And the Senate President. So,
State Senator Harriet Chandler, I'm so sorry to cut you off. We do have to go. We will have you back to talk more. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The Cannabis Control Commission is down one of its biggest equity advocates. That's because Shalene Title leaves on December 31st. Her extended term expired after serving on the commission for more than 3 years. Governor Charlie Baker has appointed AT&T executive Nerys Camargo to succeed her. Here to talk with us about that three-year tenure and what's next is Shalene Title. Welcome back to the show, Shalene.
Thank you for having me back.
Are you leaving the commission feeling successful about your agenda?
Mostly. I feel like there's been slow, steady progress and that we've made bold moves and done everything we could do. And as far as what's outstanding, I feel confident that I'm leaving the commission in the hands of people that I trust.
What's the bold move? You said bold moves. What are one or two of those that you feel the commission's made in the last 3 years?
Well, a couple of the most recent ones. First is we passed a home delivery set of regulations that will allow consumers to have deliveries of cannabis to their home next year. And the businesses will be run solely by economic empowerment and social equity businesses for the first 3 years. So it's a great way to have a modern system while making sure that we have a big section of the market put aside for equity. So I'm for that. And then we've also made some strong protections for patients, especially patients who are low income or who may have disabilities. They will be able to have caregivers grow for them at home, especially if they need a certain strain or a certain illness. So these have all been pretty bold moves, I think, in line with what the voters were hoping to see.
You know, we have come to know you here on Radio Boston as a strong advocate for the equity vision of the cannabis law when it was passed, for the economic empowerment aspects of the law and of retailing cannabis. That has been slow. It's been slow going, and I know you've been frustrated at times, and we've heard a lot from people who have tried to come through that part of the bill and open cannabis shops. On balance, are you feeling good about where we are 3 years later, and what's holding it up from more success?
Well, it has certainly been slow, but it has never stopped. So I'm feeling good about the fact that thanks to our expedited review policy, we now have more than 100 businesses that are minority-owned, women-owned, or veteran-owned that are provisionally licensed. So those are all in the pipeline. But in general, I think what's been holding up equity is, in particular, and I've talked about this a lot on this show, the local approval process has not been particularly equitable. And so we need, I think, people to call on their local officials and tell them they want to see a fair and equitable cannabis industry in Massachusetts, and that should factor into the local decisions.
You know, I've noticed in a couple of interviews and conversations recently, you've really been pretty sharp in your criticism that the local control aspect of this isn't working. What's broken and what needs to be fixed?
Well, this has been continuing for 4 years now, and it is about time that it got addressed. In particular, a host community agreement is something that is required for all businesses, and it's meant to cover things like zoning and hours of operation and signage, but cities and towns have been using it as a hostage tool to extract payments from businesses. And so it has led to a situation where the businesses that can afford to make the best payments or offer the most to a city or town, they offer that in exchange for a local license. And it doesn't happen everywhere, but it happens enough that it is a recipe for corruption. And whether it's a bill or a lawsuit or just citizens putting pressure on their local officials, it's really time for it to stop.
And do you think that's doable? What's it going to take?
I think it's doable because I think the stigma of cannabis is finally starting to lift. And I think that's allowing people to see the situation now more clearly. It also helps that there's a federal investigation in Fall River over what was given in exchange for a local license. So I do think this will be addressed one way or the other. I don't know if it will be by the legislature or in the courts, but eventually someone is going to have to enforce this law, because there is a law on the books that limits what a business can give in exchange for a host community agreement. So one way or another, it'll get enforced.
And you're talking about an investigation that's part of a larger bribery scandal involving the mayor of Fall River, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, you know, I've noticed that you were advocating for the passage of the MORE Act, which is the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act of 2019. It was passed in the House about a month ago. A minute ago, you said you think stigma is wearing off on marijuana. Do you think legal cannabis at the federal level is a matter of time? Is going to happen? May happen? Talk about that a little bit.
It is a matter of time, but how long, no one knows. I think, of course, it depends on what happens in Georgia and who controls the Senate and whether President Biden will change his mind about legalization. But one thing I know for sure is that the experience of states like Massachusetts and California and Illinois, who have led on equity, should be used in a federal legalization bill. I'm actually creating a group with some of my peers in other states called the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition. And we want to offer that expertise and early lessons to make sure that everything we've learned in these states is reflected ultimately in the federal legalization bill that does pass.
That strikes me as, to some extent, kind of parallel to the way that those who helped with RomneyCare implementation here in the Commonwealth went around the country to help with implementation when healthcare reform was passed elsewhere. Do you see that as a similar model?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I think that when you are on the cutting edge of a new policy and you make mistakes and you learn what works, it just makes sense to share that with other jurisdictions that are facing those challenges for the first time.
You know, I want to go back for just a second because the team is reminding me to be super clear that the investigation is of the former mayor of Fall River, not the current mayor, who is Paul Coogan. So just making sure I'm really clear about that in our conversation. So a couple of days from now, after a really intense and engaged service on the Cannabis Control Commission, you will be stepping down. What's the number one piece of unfinished business for you that you hope the new commission, when it's fully formed with five members, will take up?
It's a great question. I think that we evolved over the past few years to a really good model of governance where We listened to the public. We took their feedback. We discussed their feedback in public. And they could see, whether they agreed with it or not, why we made the decisions that we did. And so I know each of the new commissioners are going to make the role their own and focus on their own priorities. But I really hope to see them keeping that same model of open and transparent governance.
You know, it's been striking to watch this experience unfold here in the Commonwealth, where from the beginning, as we said, there's been a commitment to those who were disproportionately impacted by former marijuana policy having a share in the positive stakes now that cannabis is legal. When all is said and done, do you think history is going to judge that Massachusetts succeeded?
I don't think we know yet. I think so far history will judge that Massachusetts tried, but did they succeed? I don't know yet.
And what are you most hopeful about in the cannabis space for Massachusetts in 2021?
I'm hopeful that we will see the on the ground playing out of these wonderful decisions that we've made in theory with the provisionally licensed businesses that are so diverse and including of small businesses, with the new deliveries regulations, that we'll see it play out in person, and it's going to be wonderful.
And that is Shalene Title, outgoing commissioner for Massachusetts's Cannabis Control Commission. Shalene, thanks. I hope you'll come back on the show and keep providing us your insight over time.
Thank you so much.
For the last 2 weeks, we have been reflecting on 2020 from a variety of perspectives. For example, yesterday, we did the year in sports. Well, today, we are going to take probably my favorite news question of the year and ask it about the year. How big of a deal is it? That's right. Today, we are going to attempt to place 2020 in the arc of history, and I cannot wait to hear from our two guests. We have David Shribman, executive editor emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and for 10 years, the Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe. And we have Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson, assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. David and Kelly, welcome back to the show to both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, it's so great to have you. So I think we should start by going big or going home. So I'm just going to ask you straight up, how big of a deal is 2020 in the arc of history? Are we talking one of the top 20 most important years, top five, not actually even on the list? Kelly, what do you think?
I don't think it's even on the list. You know, when I think of big moments, you think of like, certainly the Spanish flu or the Great Depression or, you know, racial protests of 1968. But we haven't had all of that come together at the same exact time, all in the same year. And so for me, I know this word is like so overused, but unprecedented really is sort of what we've been experiencing this entire year.
So when you say not on the list, I think you mean it's kind of on a list of its own. Is that what you mean?
Exactly, exactly. I don't think there's anything that we could compare 2020 to. I think there's certain aspects of it that we've seen. I just don't think we've seen all of those aspects all at once clustered together in the way that we have with 2020.
David, do you agree with that?
Well, it's hard to disagree with that. And I would say only three others come close. 1776, for reasons we know, Shirley in Boston, 1861, the beginning of the Civil War, and 1941, the beginning, for America at least, of World War II. But as Professor Carter-Jackson says, we have a confluence of immense events for 2020. Like 1941, we did have Ted Williams' great season and Joe DiMaggio's great season. 1776 speaks for itself, but I think this isn't a class by itself, and I think we'd all three of us agree we'd just as soon not have lived through another competitor.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in listening to the two of you, okay, I got to be honest, I thought you were going to say it was a big deal. I wasn't expecting you to say that it was that big a deal, and I honestly don't know whether I should feel proud to have lived through it or sick to my stomach.
Well, here's the thing. If this had happened 3 years earlier or 5 years earlier, I think Professor Carter-Jackson and I would probably agree it didn't rank up there in the top three or four. But you had a presidential election. You had George Floyd. You had all sorts of things, and you had the confluence of a pandemic and technology. Now, we had this happened in 1995, he couldn't have conducted college classes by Zoom because Zoom was a verb then, not a noun. And so I think so many things converged this year that I think the Professor Carter Jackson and I are voting 2-0 on this.
Yeah, I think so. I can agree. I mean, the election, how could I forget the election? Like, the election was all consuming in the middle of this. And it's so funny. Just a few weeks ago, I was telling my husband, like, I feel like I had nothing to watch on TV. And it was because the election was over. And I felt like so much of the past 4 years really had been the election. And so this is the first time I feel like politically things have somewhat slowed down a bit. But again, we're about to experience, you know, the inauguration in another few weeks. And so it will be another, you know, 4 years of a new presidency to sort of, you know, write down for the record books. But definitely, I don't think that we will ever experience something like this again.
Well, so I want, let's hope so. And let's also agree that, you know, somebody once said that the humankind's happiest days are written on the blank pages of history. It wouldn't be so bad for our lives to feel a little empty without the president, without the tweets. It wouldn't be so bad.
So I do want to take each of the pieces because both of you have listed a bunch of stuff here. But before we do, I do want to ask one more question about the interaction of those pieces, right? So I've kind of been running through the year in my head for lots of reasons the last couple of weeks. We go all the way back to, we thought we might go to war at the beginning of 2020. Then the Senate voted not to convict the president on impeachment. We had the election. We had the pandemic. We had our great racial reckoning. Would any one or two of these have been enough to make this really historically one heck of a year? Or is it the fact that they were a confluence and they depended on each other to happen that makes this year so historically remarkable? Kelly, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, I do think I don't think we pay attention to George Floyd without the pandemic, because George Floyd is not the first. You know, we saw a similar death with Eric Garner and with so many others, Mike Brown, and it did not garner the same kind of national and international and prolonged attention that we saw this past summer. And I think that's because the pandemic forced us to stop and there was nothing much else to look at. And this was something that was quite grim for us to witness, because, you know, the footage is all there for you to see, 8 minutes and 46 seconds. So, yeah, I do think that it was dependent upon one another. I think I can't imagine what the experience of George Floyd would have looked like had it not been for the pandemic.
David, is that your take as well, that that was the interplay between all of these massive events that made the year, or would one or two of them alone have been enough to make this an historically remarkable year?
Well, George Floyd's death would have been unnecessary and inexcusable any year, but it was particularly poignant when Donald Trump was president. The pandemic would have been a big deal. I mean, immense numbers of deaths, tragedy after tragedy. But it was even greater because of who was president and how he handled it. You know, I mentioned 1776 earlier. Somebody wrote a musical about 1776. If you wrote a musical about 2020, it would be a dirge. And the best thing we can say for the year is that it was the year 2020. And if we look at it with 2020 hindsight, we're going to regard it as a year of tragedy.
So I want to now
dive into
it. Any
year that leadership matters.
So say some more about that, Kelly.
Well, going back to what was said, I think leadership really matters. How you handle a crisis, how you handle these conflicts. You know, a lot of the deaths that we saw came from, you know, this inability to act swiftly, to act clearly, to act across the board, collectively, to have a national federal response, I think could have saved a lot of lives.
especially if we had acted much sooner. I don't think you can underestimate not just national leadership, but local leadership, how people have experienced the pandemic in small towns like Waterloo, Idaho, versus how they've experienced pandemics in a place like New York City. All of that matters.
Let me just a quick follow-up question there. I apologize for my ignorance, Kelly, but why pick Waterloo? Is there something specific there that I'm
Waterloo
missing?
I picked Waterloo because one of my good friends is the public health director there, but also because
got it.
They had the largest outbreak at the Tyson plant there. And I don't think we realize how much the Tyson plant was a microcosm of what was to happen in the rest of the country. The fact that they were working in close quarters, the fact that they had not prepared their employees or had prepared masks for their employees, and you know that there are so many people who lost their lives in a relatively small town with this one plant that's responsible for feeding all of America. But it's these small towns that are working hard as essential workers to feed America that are also sort of representative of how we could handle a response like this so much better at larger levels and local levels and state levels.
And
just
so
I know, was it Iowa or Idaho, Kelly? I'm so sorry.
Waterloo, Iowa.
Okay, David, go ahead.
Interesting that it was called a Waterloo, right? But we began the year deploring and worrying about the wage gap, and we end the year seeing that the class gap really played itself out with this disease, which is a kind of tragedy upon tragedy. And I would add one other thing. The last three presidents, save this one, were pastors in large regard. President Clinton had played a pastoral role. President Bush, after 9/11, was the nation's pastor. Surely Obama played a pastoral role, particularly at the South Carolina funeral. Mm-hmm. This president abjured the pastoral role. It was a huge break from what had been, a 24-year pattern of presidents playing a pastoral role. And I think that was significant, and I think that changed the tone of this whole thing.
So I want to play two pieces of sound for the two of you that I think get to the point you're making, David, and also get to some stuff that you wrote about earlier this year, Kelly. So I'm going to start with actually some sound from Joe Biden accepting the presidential nomination and adopting, David, what I think one might say is a more pastoral tone. Here he is.
I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together. And make no mistake, united we can and will overcome this season of darkness in America.
So there's Biden accepting the nomination and using a kind of rhetoric that we most markedly have not heard from President Donald Trump. I want to play alongside that a cut of actually L.A. Clippers coach and former Boston Celtics coach Doc Rivers, who gave an emotional response to the NBA players' decision to boycott games and talked about the narrative portrayed specifically at the Republican National Convention around a focus on fear and rioting with the protests. He said that focus ignored the roots of the problem. Here he is.
We're the ones that were denied to live in certain communities. We've been hung. We've been shot. And all you do is keep hearing about fear. It's amazing to me why we keep loving this country and this country does not love us back.
So, Kelly, we talked with you earlier in the year about some writing you did on the double standard of the American riot. Can you just reflect on those two cuts for a minute? And then, David, I'm going to come back to you, too. Kelly.
I mean, that Doc Rivers quote gets me every time. And it's because it's nonsensical when we think about how racial violence has operated in this country. It is primarily flowed in one direction, that black people are always the majority of the victims when it comes to racial violence. You know, we don't hear about black people blowing up churches or going into white churches and shooting white people during a prayer meeting. We don't hear about four little girls that are killed in a church bombing by a black man. We don't even hear about mass shootings taking place by black people in a Walmart intent to kill white people. Like, this violence only majoritarily operates in one direction, and that is against people of color and black people in particular. And so I think we've just not had a very honest conversation about the hypocrisy that is fueling the fear that people have, this unrational fear that people have. And, you know, I'm constantly asking the question as well, you know, who should be afraid of whom when we think about the police and when we think about these protests in which unarmed protesters are like matched up against armies. This is not a fair fight. Visually, it's not a fair fight, but physically, it's certainly not a fair fight. And I think these are things that we're going to have to grapple with going forward, certainly if we want to see change.
And David, we have grappled with our rhetoric around our observations of peaceful protests. There has been violence and riots as well. And the role, and you raised this earlier, that our leadership plays in how we relate to each other, whether we're dialed up, who thinks they have the upper hand. That's not a very satisfying way to describe it, but it's the best I've got right now. Reflect on that and what that means for 2021.
Well, I think what Professor Carter Jackson said is true through every syllable of what she had to say. Presidents Obama and President Clinton and really George W. Bush understood this. But the last white leader who actually expressed this was Robert Kennedy the night that Martin Luther King was killed, when he reflected in Indianapolis at the airport that his brother had also been killed by a white man. And we haven't had that kind of, we've had a racial reckoning here, but it's only been skin deep, and it hasn't been with the depth that we've been talking about today, and we still need that, and it can only break every American's heart to hear that Doc Rivers thing, and every time you hear it, your heart breaks even more.
Hmm. Kelly, in our last minute, if you teach about this year one day, what's the theme of the class?
Oh, resistance and resilience. I think those are the two biggest things that we've seen this year. Americans fight against a pandemic, but also fight back and work together collectively. I hope those are things that we can take away, resistance and resilience.
And David, if you wrote a book, what would the theme of the book or the title of the book be?
I would go back to the last sentence of President Johnson's voting rights speech in 1966, or it might have been 65, or it could have been from the 64 speech, in which he said, "We shall overcome, and Americans, we must overcome these problems."
Well, I got to tell you, that was a really satisfying conversation for me, and I learned so much from the both of you. David Shribman, executive editor emeritus of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and former Washington bureau chief of the Boston Globe, as well as Professor Kelly Carter Jackson, assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Thanks so much to both of you.
Well, thank you, too.
Thank you.